screening at the Dock Edge Film Festival this coming week is a documentary that tackles the question, are we living in a simulation? Well, the famous writer Philip K. Dick thought so, and he makes an appearance in this documentary in a fairly famous speech he gave in the 1970s. But a famous line from a movie is what most of us are more familiar with. Lawrence Fishburne in the film The Matrix as the character Morpheus telling Neo, played by Keanu Reeves, about the choice he has to make.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Documentary maker Rodney Asher made the well-received The Nightmare about the phenomenon of sleep paralysis. He's tackled a bigger topic with A Glitch in the Matrix. Perhaps the biggest topic of all. Elon Musk thinks about this a lot. He reckons astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson apparently said he finds it hard to argue against the idea that we live in a simulation. Hello, Rodney.
Hi, great to talk to you.
You too. I'm assuming, having seen this documentary of yours, you haven't made your mind up about whether we are all being deceived by what we experience in our lives, Rodney.
I think that's fair to say. You know, if the making the film was part of my attempt to settle the question, I failed abjectly.
Well, just briefly, would you mind describing what you set out to do and how, and then we can discuss some of the big ideas you throw at us?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's the last few years I've become sort of increasingly interested in simulation theory, which, I mean, I think the shortest way to describe it is the idea that this whole world is a digital creation and some sort of unbelievably powerful computer out there someplace, right? Whether out there is another dimension, another planet, or even, I think a lot of people talk about it as people from our own future who have simulated the past, right? So as I've seen that idea sort of grow in popularity and track it over the last few years, the film was sort of an attempt to both discuss the idea in broad strokes, to talk to people who've come to believe it and see like what kind of things have happened to them that inspired them. And so a lot of the visual approach of the film, because we talk so much about digital worlds, digital ideas, digital creations, you know, as much as we could, I tried to make the film a digital creation. So all of the interviews were done over the internet. There's an awful lot of 3D digital animation done in a variety of different styles.
Yes, the animations are an art form in themselves, so congratulations on those. Among the many interesting postulations in your film is that of the 7-point-whatever-number-it-is-billion people in the world, the vast majority could be non-playing characters like you'd find in video games. They don't interact with you, or if they do, it's minimal. You know, they can say good morning, or they can grunt, or they can sit down on a park bench or walk into a shop or whatever. And I found this concept quite entrancing, Rodney, and I thought the way to test it would be to assemble some mates and deliberately try to engage all these people in more complex interactions, or set up cameras in a shopping mall and observe all their rudimentary behaviours. And then we'd know we were living in a simulation designed to fool us.
Well, it's a recipe for an interesting afternoon anyway. I know I've heard stories of people sort of picking random strangers to, you know, try to get to know or follow or to try to get a deep look into their lives. But, I mean, that question in itself, you know, at some points it gets sort of eerie, right, as you kind of divide people into the folks who are fully human and those that are less than. And, you know, looking at the video game comparison, there are some games, you know, like a Fortnite-style game where every character you see on screen is in some ways tethered to an actual human being, you know, versus a game like where the player is the only, you know, single human in the machine. And, you know, I think if once you start to spin scenarios for simulated worlds, that's the first fork in the road that you come to, right? The question of, well, what does this mean about other people?
The only single human in the machine. Are we actually deep down talking about old-fashioned solipsism? That word appears in your documentary, the idea that the world is a simulacrum for my benefit.
Well, certainly we are, if we're talking about, simulation theory as a metaphor, for reality or, a quasi-religious creation story, in that capacity, yeah, it has an awful lot in common with, sort of Descartes' philosophy or the story of, Plato's cave, or even, you could go deep into Eastern traditions that talk about the same notions of, sort of the illusory quality of the world. And, looking at it in those contexts, you could say it's a 21st century skin on an ancient idea, but there are people, who have sort of come at this from, a deeply technological viewpoint. And they think that by understanding quantum physics or string theory or, trying to find, the ultimate, the smallest pixel size of the world around us, even I've heard people talk about trying to find computer code in DNA, that they think of it, quite literally.
Yes. A glitch in the matrix, and we're talking to the man who made it, Rodney Asher, screening at the Dock Edge Festival in association with RNZ. You have to ask the question at some point when you're watching, am I so special that a superior intelligence would want to give me a personalized ride through life? And even if I were, what's the point? I personally would prefer more holidays on the Riviera, Rodney.
Fair enough. But I think you get to that question, through most, religious explanations for the nature of reality as well.
Yes. And much of the movie, that's true, much of the movie you've made centers around the prognostications of the admittedly amazing writer Philip K. Dick, who bequeathed us many ideas, one of which became Blade Runner and The Man in the High Castle, etc. And you have found this great footage, old footage of Philip K. Dick expounding his philosophy. And he was fantastically inventive, but he was also a bit paranoid in real life.
No, that's absolutely true. But some of what he says, especially in that speech from 1977, seems so prescient that in some ways, I kind of think of him as patient zero of, neuroses that were going to become increasingly common in the 21st century.
Yes, and I'm not dismissing what he says because he was paranoid, because he was also extremely clever. But you could say that those out on the edge mentally are seeing the world properly, or that they're seeing the world a bit extravagantly. And his kind of, dark epiphany did come after an experience with the barbiturate sodium pentothal, I think.
Yes, true enough.
All right, so you think of someone, you turn the corner, and there they are. We've all had experiences of synchronicities, and many can be quite startling. Out of interest, have you had any?
Oh, I've had a ton, and a lot of them were just came through to the making of this film. We made the decision to, film all of our interviews, via video chats, Skype windows, and things back in 2019, and even to go so far as to, replace some of these folks with animated characters. And one of the strange things is that, after the pandemic, it hit all of us around the world in 2020, we found ourselves trapped in those video conferencing bubbles.
Yeah. No, the visual treatment is wholly original. Just getting back to synchronicities, they often seem to mean nothing and lead nowhere. I mean, we've all had these, I'm sure, strange episodes, but those glitches in the matrix, if they are, seem to be superficial often and appear inconsequential, and they fascinate us, but I suppose they could be coincidences. And if they aren't, and this is the other idea that emerges in the film at one point, the only explanation might be that we create them. We engineer the glitches in the matrix. And to restate that question I asked before, if we do, why don't we do it a whole lot better than we are doing, so our world's more flashy and exciting, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, even Jung wrote a lot about synchronicities, and I think he had the simplest explanation for them, which was correlation without causation. But, they've long been associated with, if not simulation theory, just the idea that there is, if it's not someone's finger on the scale, that there is a purpose, a pattern, a destiny. And I think a lot of folks, myself included, find synchronicities. For me, I find it as a sometimes as a feeling of, well, maybe I'm on the right track, that more and more of these things are starting to happen.
I wish in my case they were as supportive as that. Speaking as of supporters, Elon Musk is the best known one for the ideas in your documentary. He makes the argument that video games are so good now that they'll become indistinguishable from reality. But Rodney, we know, don't we, when we put a headset on, that although we can get lost in a game, that it is always acting upon us. It's still apart from us. You know, if we're chasing someone through a medieval castle, we don't bang into the walls. And a truly realistic video game would have to assemble technology so complex it's unimaginable to us at the moment, you would think.
Yeah, well, I think what he was saying at this conference, you know, and, you know, when he talked about it, it went viral pretty quickly. And I certainly noticed that as, you know, a real milestone in the mainstreaming of simulation theory. You know, and it's one of the reasons that we include that clip in film. But, you know, he's using a pretty neat article, a neat argument with maybe a little bit of sleight of hand, tracking how quickly video games have advanced, and then suggesting if they continue on this route, at a certain point, they'll be indistinguishable from reality, whether that point is 10, 50, or 500 years from now. And then there's this sort of, you know, sort of big idea, which is assuming that if you take a step back and sort of look at the past, present, and future from some godlike perspective outside of it, if that will eventually be possible, right? As soon as they create more than one fully believable reality, once there are two or three, they'll quickly outnumber the one real reality. And then statistically, as the argument goes, it's more likely that you're in one of the multiple simulations instead of the one and only real world, or as they call it, base reality.
Yeah, that's a mind-boggling scenario, that one. It's been said by people much cleverer than me, though, that to simulate a universe, this black sphere, this elegant black sphere of a computer that you visually postulate in this film of yours, that it would need to replicate phenomena down to the quantum level because the matrix itself is so large. I guess to simplify all this, and big brains are battling over the topic, you know, we have no way of imagining the ability at the moment to create something so vast.
Well, actually, Nick Bostrom, the philosopher who wrote an essay in 2003 that was really influential in, you know, in the idea of simulation theory, he actually does a fair amount of incredibly complicated math trying to estimate how much computer power, you know, this matrix generating machine would need. And, you know, I'm not embarrassed to say that the math equation that he writes is utterly baffling, you know, to my poor brain. But again, people smarter than me see it as plausible.
Yeah. No, utterly baffling to my small brain as well. But I saw Dmitry Kovrazin at Oxford University saying building a computer with enough memory would require more atoms than there are in the universe. But these are two clever men who completely disagree. And it's very difficult to, you know, sort through that. The physics here, and this is the really interesting implication, or one of them, from your doco, the physics turns into metaphysics, doesn't it? Because if there are blips in the matrix, glitches in the matrix, they could also be God's glitches. And a lot of people have always believed that.
Yeah, and that was something that was a surprise to me. Like, going in, I thought we were going to mostly be talking about, you know, sort of ideas from science fiction, but one person after another, you know, started drifting into religious ideas.
And in fact, if we are religious, the world is a construct, and phenomena like miracles, I suppose, are glitches in the matrix, and the server room would be heaven.
Right. Well, I mean, if you go down into, you imagine a game from a programmer's point of view, right? And they're not bound by, you know, the same rules and the same abilities as the user.
Yeah. Well, such interesting ideas, experiences and memories of an alternative present time or a different version in your head of recent history. This is interesting. And the example given, not by you, but someone in this film, is the hundreds of thousands of people who believe Nelson Mandela died in prison, which is fascinating. But I suppose they could be people who just don't pay much attention to current affairs, if there are, And they conflate the well-known and, you know, permeating memory of his long prison term with his dying. I suppose that's another possibility.
Yeah, well, I've actually read that that might be that people are confusing one South African activist political figure with another. So the Berenstain, the spelling of Berenstain Bears, which is one that a lot of people discuss, was kind of a shock to me, as was the fact that the evil queen in Snow White never says mirror, mirror on the wall. But what I really found, you know, amazing about the Mandela effect phenomenon was how Philip K. Dick, again, sort of predicted it. You know, in his speech, he talks about misremembering the past. A clue to the simulation would be that is when the past has changed and a few handful of people, for reasons unknown, remember the way it was originally. And he says, you know, if only we could find someone who remembers alternate pasts. And lo and behold, in the 21st century, people are obsessed with these things. And there are huge, you know, lists on the on message boards on the internet of these so-called Mandela effects.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I'd forgotten about Steve Biko, and who died in prison, for example, and perhaps conflating that with Nelson Mandela. I won't get into the Berenstain Bears because it's quite complicated. But but the mirror, mirror on the wall was originally magic mirror, wasn't it?
Oh, apparently that's the way it always was, you know, unless you subscribe to the theory that someone went back in time and changed it. But right. I would have sworn it was mirror, mirror.
Yeah, I would have too. Kelly Conway, of course, gave us alternative facts when Donald Trump was president. And I suppose to illustrate her idea, all you have to do is have the CNN app and the Fox News app on your cell phone and flick between them to see the day's news analyzed, actually, Rodney.
Yeah, well, that's where, you know, we get into sort of simulation theory as a metaphor, and I think a really relevant one to these days. Sometimes the stories that you hear reported, they may be more or less accurate reporting of the facts, or depending on, you know, where you're getting, you know, depending what media environment you're swimming in, they might be outright distortions. And based on those, people are, you know, creating their worldview inside of their heads. They're building a simulation of the world as best they can, you know, with the information that's hitting them to their five senses.
And in that way, your film truly reflects what's going on. A Glitch in the Matrix, we're talking with Rodney Asher. As well as all the fun, because there is a lot of fun in your documentary, there is, tragically, Joshua Conway, who was a Matrix super fan and then went and shot his parents so he could truly feel like Keanu Reeves in a trench coat. There is also a great sadness, you know, an alienation embedded in this notion that we see nothing really real, Rodney.
Yeah, well, I mean, Josh's story, I thought, you know, was incredibly tragic. And, you know, his story is ultimately, you know, a very, very complicated one. He describes it as a perfect storm in which the Matrix and simulation theory were one problem he was going through amongst many. But a lot of the stories wound up having their sad ends. I mean, in many ways, simulation theory can be kind of a lonely worldview, right? Where you're not even sure whether or not you're the only person, you're the only real person.
Yeah, and people, that's right. And people dive into, well, I dived into Netflix, actually. I was going to say dive into games, but I dived into Netflix. And it's not just the cartoon shows that are showing escapes from reality. I mean, half the content is fantasy or reality with magic added. So we don't like too much reality we never have, but at least religion, for all its bad aspects, gave us, or gives us, arguably, of course, subscriptions have fallen off, principles and morals and mantras. But it's a free-for-all now. It's the age of me, 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 and I suppose it truly is a solipsistic sort of time.
Well, you know, I don't know if it is more than other times, but I mean, that's always it does sometimes feel like the 21st century or the second half of the 20th can be a lonelier one, despite all these, despite all the technology we have that is supposed to bring us together. But, you know, during the pandemic, I've got to say, Skype and instant chats and, you know, messages on my phone were a panacea to keep me connected to my family and friends. And, you know, I think my son, my 10-year-old son, played more video games than I might have liked, but he would log in with them, and they would often be not just a thing that he could do, but when he met his friends, it was a place that he could go, you know, and it was a social place. So I think there's two sides to the coin.
Yes, that's right. There is a lot of sociability with game playing, as I've found from my own son, actually. So the images and ideas in your film haunted me for a good half a day and made me think about all sorts of aspects, which is what your film's designed to do. But has it stayed in your head too? Because you've been so immersed in this notion, in these notions. What's it done to you?
It's certainly changed the way I look at the world and I think about our interconnections on the one hand, and having these conversations with folks like you, and, you know, as the movie travels, I get to have them, you know, these sort of kind of deep, personal, thoughtful conversations with new people is something that, you know, I really treasure. It's one of my favorite parts of making a film is, you know, getting able to share it and discuss it afterwards. Though there also comes a point, and I'm probably getting near there, where making the film, talking about it, at a certain point that exhausts my interest in this subject, and it isn't as if I've necessarily solved the riddles. Being able to ask these questions and struggle with these ideas, you know, for 2-3 years at a time, sometimes helps me put them behind me and look for the next one.
You're all matrixed out now.
I'm getting there.
Lovely to talk to you, and thank you very much for your time. It'll be so interesting to see how your film's received here.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Rodney Asher.